This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined, as always, by Bradley Chambers. No sponsor this week, but if you want to sponsor the show, you can get in touch through our website, outofschool.net. How are you doing, Bradley?
I am absolutely fantastic. How about you?
I'm not too bad. We're coping with some broken nights of sleep with the new baby, but other than that, we're fine. I understand you've got a new baby this week as well.
Yes.
In the form of some metal.
Yes, yesterday. Well, it's crazy because I got the shipment of my computer over the weekend, like the notification, and it said it would be in Wednesday. Then all of a sudden, like it went from somewhere in China to Alaska and then to Memphis, Tennessee, very, very quickly. And it was in Memphis on Sunday. And so I really had a sneaking suspicion that it would show up on Monday, and it did. So I am the proud new user of a 2012 MacBook Air, 8 gigs of RAM, and a 512 gigabyte SSD. I wish I could have put 16 gigs of RAM, but I guess that's what they qualify as a first world problem.
Indeed. Indeed, that's it. That's you a pro if you want 16 gigs of RAM.
Yeah, and I really like the, I guess, portability of the Air, and my days of running VMware are coming to a close. Our student information system is really the main reason I run VMware on this machine. The administrator piece requires Windows, but that's going away rather soon. They actually just had a great new update to their iPad app today, or the release of an iPad app today. So with that, you know, when those days end, I probably don't have a need for 16 gigs day to day. And having an SSD drive has really been nice. And what I guess the biggest thing that blows my mind is the display, because I was still using a 2009 MacBook Pro 13-inch. And so just seeing that, I guess, to me, this looks like a Retina display, I guess, in some ways.
Yeah, because that the Air has got a higher resolution than that old machine. Is that right? In the same space?
Absolutely. And so, yeah, so everything is the bright. Yeah. It's brighter. Again, I'm so weird. I will run my Mac into the ground, but I always want the latest iPhone or the latest iPad. But, you know, this is, and really just feature wise, I guess the only thing that's new to me is the power nap feature. But I really don't ever put my machine to sleep. I just kind of walk away. I guess it goes to sleep and does its thing, but really haven't noticed it too much. And I'm also, I think I mentioned last week, I have a brand new closet that was finished today. I have a closet that is bigger than my office. We, I'm in the process of starting to roll out our new Apple gear. And we'll talk about that more in depth on a future show. But I have some nice new shelves that I'm storing things on. And I'll tell you what's interesting, and I tweeted about this, I think it was yesterday, is how much more efficient Apple has gotten at packing just in the past 3 years. We got roughly the same number of pieces, if not quite, you know, probably more. And it felt like it took up a lot less room. You know, they're shipping boxes that Amazon would, I feel like they would put a flash drive in. And I was getting 5 MacBook Airs in.
Things have just gotten so much smaller, you know, and I think you're right that they're just packing things tighter, and they're also putting less in the box as well. You know, if you open up a new laptop, now you've got the laptop power brick, and our UK power brick is of course 25 times larger than your one, because of the stupid plug that we have in this country. But you know, you've got that, you've got your little extension cord, and a couple of bits of paper that the lawyers say they have to put in the box, I guess, and that's it. You know, not even recovery software or anything like that either anymore.
No, that's nice, especially if you know have a lease or a makeup of various models. You don't really have to worry about keeping a restore disk per model. I basically just have Mountain Lion installed on a flash drive, and if I need it, you know, due to actually a hardware failure, I've got it right there. So it kind of allowed me to throw away a lot of old CDs and DVDs.
Good times. Good times. It's interesting, just probably worth reflecting on as well. You know, I had the first ever MacBook Air, which, you know, the one with the little door that popped down with one USB port and the mini DVI plug in it and so on. And that was such a kind of luxury device back then. You know, it was ridiculous, the amount of money that I paid for it, and how kind of weak it was. And today, look at what the MacBook Air is. It's kind of like the low-end workhorse of the line. You know, it does for almost everybody except those who genuinely need, you know, Retina displays, 16 gigs of RAM, massive hard drives on board or whatever. It's just interesting it's the Mac example of, you know, devices just becoming more powerful and apparently, you know, much simpler devices taking over much more of the kind of day-to-day work that people do. And again, we're seeing the same thing with iPad, that lots and lots and lots of people can handle just having an iPad to work on, and a MacBook Air is the same. You know, it's the only computer I'm using right now, and I used to think I needed a Mac Pro with 2 30-inch displays and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, in some ways I miss those machines, but I don't miss the cost, and I don't miss the complexity, and I don't miss the heat that they generated in my office and so on as well. So it's the future's bright.
Was that the MacBook Air that literally had the iPod hard drive in it?
Yeah, it had the 1.8-inch. Was it Philips, I think, made the hard drive there? That you could get an SSD option at that point, but it was like £800 or £900 to get a 64-gig SSD in it. And that, I think that was the first time Apple offered SSDs in any machine, but I obviously didn't go for that option. I just had the hard drive version. That machine actually worked. My sister used it for a number of years after I moved on from it, and I think it's only just been retired this year. So it did a good job for a long time.
Well, this is allowing us to retire our 2008 unibody MacBook, you know, the only MacBook line that was the aluminum. And it's, you know, it's still a great computer. You know, it's amazing how kind of over the years, the Apple's devices, even though they're not the latest and greatest, if you just are doing basic stuff, they seem to work. You know, show me a 5-year-old Dell laptop that still is worth anything.
Yeah, I mean, in our school, we're still running the first ever generation, the iMac 4.1, the first ever Intel iMacs, and they're still working. You know, they're only running Snow Leopard. That's their maximum OS that they can run, but they are, you know, doing the job. They're still mainly being used just to sync iPads right now, but you know, that's the way they're spending their declining years, I guess. Cool. So, what are we talking about this week?
A couple things. A couple things we got. We're going to talk about two new products from our friends over at Aerohiv, and then we're going to take the rest of the show to kind of cull through the listener feedback pile. We've got quite a few, you know, emails that have come through, and so we'll kind of answer some of those questions. I had one today, which was actually really timely because I've dealt with this issue in recent days. We'll go through that in a few minutes, but of course, listeners of the show for a long time will know that Fraser and I both are big fans of Aerohive's wireless products. Both of our schools are Aerohive schools. Really, if you talk to Apple today and say, I want to deploy iPads, who do I get for my wireless? And they'll say Aerohive. And you know, one of the things that I found that is different than in years past, you know, in years past, Apple would just sell you iPads and Macs and good to go. But I think now they have realized that if you don't have a wireless infrastructure that's up to snuff, that you're going to have a poor experience, and that will reflect poorly on Apple. So it seems to me from my talkings with their systems engineers, they're much more interested in your infrastructure than they used to be. And to me, it just really makes sense. You know, Aerohive is a pioneer of the controllerless wireless solutions, which really make it for kind of rapid deployment, and it allows you to scale up as you need more access points. You just add more access points. There's no worries about maxing out a controller. Had a friend of the show, Justin North. He recently just switched over to Aerohive, and one of the main reasons was he kind of outgrown his controller with his previous system. Needed to add more access points and really couldn't.
Yeah, that's more and more as I talk to schools. I mean, there are other Wi-Fi companies as well. This isn't the Aerohive show per se, but you know, it's the service that we've experienced with, and more and more I'm hearing from the schools who I guess what I'm trying to say is that one of the things that gives me confidence in a school's approach to technology deployment is that they are thinking seriously about Wi-Fi as well. You know, they've recognized that there is a much bigger story to be told than just what devices are we putting on our network, but is our network going to cope, and is the broadband going to cope? And more and more, I mean, I'm meeting people who have already thought about density issues with Wi-Fi as well, which is really encouraging to see that kind of message is starting to get through, that you have to think about more than just how many devices can I possibly afford. And in some ways, you might be better taking some budget off of the devices and putting a bit more into infrastructure, because then you can obviously put more devices on as you grow.
One of the issues I've had to kind of tinker with here recently is my DHCP lease time. We have across the way from our school, we have a family life center that our church owns, and we share a network with, and we have our own private fiber running under the street. And we, you know, typically at least time is 24 hours, a lot of people use. And so if you're not familiar with DHCP, it's how you get basically an IP address internally. Well, if you do a 24-hour lease, at 12 hours, the device goes and tries to renew and continues to try to renew and until the lease expires. So we have a lot of people that what I consider to be flyby users. Like they'll come in for 30 minutes for a meeting, then they leave. They'll get on the guest network, for 30, 45 minutes and they're out the door. Well, they were holding that, since it was a 24-hour lease, they were holding a lease on the network for 24 hours. So my highest traffic day on the network is Sunday, when I generally might have 500-600 people on campus, at any given point. Mm-hmm. So that made for some tight DHCP issues on Monday. And I was never running out, but it was getting to where I might only have 200 to 300 available at a time. And I really don't like to run it that close. And so I cut our lease time to 12 hours. And so that way, if someone was on campus at 8 p.m. the night before for a meeting or for a school function at a basketball game or something like that, I knew by 8 o'clock the next morning they would be off the network, from a DHCP perspective. And that's drastically helped. One of the things I'm actually working on right now is a recable of our building. We're getting some quotes, and I'm actually making a presentation on that in the morning. And I'll drastically rebuild our guest network where it doesn't affect our kind of internal DHCP scope, because that's an issue. It's not even a wireless issue. It's just a wired LAN issue that as you grow, you have to kind of account for things like that.
Yeah, we have always traditionally run Cedars has typically been based on one subnet and everybody on the same subnet. And mostly for simplicity, and that's worked pretty well for us so far. But as we went to kind of one-to-one, we started to get close to the limit and so on. So when we first put in our AeroHive with our Apple network, we'd always run it with a one-hour DHCP lease. And then when we put in AeroHive, the default, I think, was 24 hours there. And we actually quite quickly ran out of numbers because so many people were coming on. We were getting close to 256 or whatever. And we found that people were holding on to leases too long, so we had to pretty quickly cut that back to the usual 1 hour that we use. And in the summer, we've got a plan to sort of separate out the traffic between a staff VLAN, student VLAN, and a visitor VLAN, so that we'll have enough headroom in the numbers there such that we could allow students to put their own smartphones on the network if we wanted to. And have many more guests come onto the network as well, because we have enough bandwidth. It was just things like DHCP leases were starting to get a little tight for us as well.
Yeah, it's always, to me, good to stay on a single VLAN, a single subnet as long as possible, because when you do change, you do add a little bit more complexity. But at some point, as your organization grows and the number of devices grow, you really just have to.
Sure, numbers dictate that you have to eventually outgrow that. To cut in on you there, but I was just going to say that many of the situations I've been to where people are saying, oh, the iPad's really hard to network and we can't get these Apple TVs working and so on, it's because they've been like incredibly clever with the structure of their VLANs, to the point where they've just, every room has got a different VLAN, and every floor's got a different VLAN, or this or that, or the library's got a different VLAN from the classroom next door and all these kind of things. And it seems to me the more rules and structure you put in place to these things, the more things you will break the rules with as you kind of start to develop and start to use new technologies and new devices. You'll start to bump into those rules more and more often.
Well, and because that's exactly right, because not only even a couple of years ago, you would maybe account for one device per user. Well, like I've actually got one user right now that has a laptop, that has an iPhone, that has an iPad, and now has one of those LiveScribe pins. So I've got four DHCP leases on that one user. And it's interesting, when we talked about OpenDNS Umbrella, that they don't count their subscriptions as number of devices, as number of users. Mm-hmm. Because I think that at this point they realize that users are going to have minimum two generally connections to the network, if not more. Imagine in the future if somebody says, hey, you get this great wireless solution, I want to bring in my Wi-Fi enabled picture frame, and they put that on the guest network. And I mean, you can see, eventually, like I talked to a guy on Twitter last night that his new washer and dryer is Wi-Fi enabled and has a smartphone app.
The world we live in, eh? And there's always other things coming in as well. There's sensors, and we've got a Wi-Fi microscope, and we've got these video boards, and just everything's got Wi-Fi in it now. And then you're going to have people coming in with like Arduino boards that want Wi-Fi, or these little Twine sensors that you can get on Kickstarter that want a Wi-Fi, you know. This is just going to go and grow and grow and grow. And I think even if you don't need your multiple VLAN structure right now, you're going to need it either pretty soon or certainly eventually.
So one of the things that our friends at Aerohive released recently, they released a switch platform and then what they also are calling their application control platform. And we'll have links to both of these in the show notes. The switches are out now and the application control is coming out, believe later on this month or the 1st of April. And the application control will be a free upgrade if you have, you know, for devices that are, I guess, what was the term I'm looking for? Not end of life, you know, devices.
Yeah, so anything that's under a valid support contract.
Right. And get the updates. And so that's one of the things that really draws me to Aerohive is they don't feature license you to death. You know, that's one of the my big complaints with our SonicWall device is it's every feature seems like it's $500 a year. Where Aerohive, it's no feature licensing. You know, basically we're adding a feature. And so we'll start with the switches. And again, I'll have a link to these in the show notes. And so they have a 24-port switch that's available today. And then they have a 48-port switch that's coming out, I believe, in the summer. Just your typical layer 2 switch. You know, the key for me, and again, we won't go into all the technical details of the switches because there's a lot of things in there, things that are well over my head. But, you know, I kind of look at my network as wireless is the main entry point at this point. The majority of my users are connecting to my network through Wi-Fi. And so by integrating my wired network into my wireless network, I get even kind of greater access and greater control over what's going on. I have one less interface to look at. And so it integrates right into your Hive Manager login. And so you can go in there and you know, customize it on a port by port basis. And you can say, okay, this port's an access point, this port's a phone, this port is a desktop, and you can kind of give them each kind of granular permissions. Again, I'm way oversimplifying it there, but the cabling project I mentioned earlier, we were looking at putting in probably 10 to 12 Aerohive switches as well.
Yeah, they look pretty exciting, I have to say. I think we're probably going to get one of the 24s to replace some. There's some crusty old Netgear stuff that I put in the first day I was in the job at Cedars. And those things have worked fine the whole time. There's absolutely nothing wrong with them except they're just, the fans are very loud on them. So about 2 years ago, because I was teaching in the room where they are, I disconnected the fans. So I just, I don't know if that was the best thing for their thermal durability or so on, but it was that or my sanity, so the fans had to go. So I don't know that the Aerohive ones are fanless. I know some people, D-Link, I think, make a line of fanless switches, which are pretty cool. But we'll see how that goes. I hope they're quiet at least.
I've got one sitting above me. They sent me one yesterday to test out. But my Hive Manager account, it requires Hive Manager 6.0, which is a big, from the ground up redesign of their interface, and it requires that, and I don't have that yet, so I really can't use the switch until I get that upgrade. Of course, I don't have time this week to even fool with it. I'll probably start tinkering with it once I get all of our new gear rolled out. But it's from a I guess look standpoint, it looks great. I think it has a switch. I'm looking up at it, or a fan. I think it has a fan, but I'm really excited about it. And again, it just goes back to the integration standpoint. And so pricing will obviously vary from industry to industry and from number of switches purchased at a time. But I'll have a link to that in the show notes. But again, if you're to me, the whole thing, it's kind of like with the Apple. You can integrate everything together with Apple. It's like we have their iPads, we have their Macs. They all kind of work seamlessly. And I like that strategy from a network perspective, because if I want to do a new feature that I need somebody's help on, I don't have to try to coordinate three or four different vendors. I just kind of have one vendor to, hug or choke, depending on what goes on.
Indeed. So Hive Manager 6.0, which Hive Manager, for those who are not familiar with Aerohive, is their online control system for your access points. The idea being that you log into your Hive Manager account, all of your access points are connected to that, and that's where you can define policy, and then you basically fire out to all of the access points that are talking to your Hive Manager. And obviously the big deal about the Aerohive switch is that now appears in the same interface, subject to the same policies and all that kind of thing. So it's it looks like a big upgrade. I mean, personally, though, the thing I'm most excited about is that Flash is gone, as far as I understand it. That all of the kind of graphing and the monitoring that's done in the interface is now all HTML5 instead of Flash, which means full service on your iPad, which is awesome.
Yeah, that is a big upgrade to me as well. And that goes right into kind of their next announcement, which the one I'm most excited about is the application control. And so, and we'll have a link to this in the show notes. They have a video, they have a white paper you can watch. But, you know, in a simplistic manner, this is where you could go in there, and it's done on a user profile level. So within Aerohive's system, you can have various user profiles, but you could tie, you know, one user profile to one SSID, for example. But you could say this user profile gets Netflix, this one doesn't, or this one gets YouTube.
User profile being a set of attributes that are applied to a group of users, is that right?
That's correct. And so you could say, these are all of my student devices, they get these permissions. These are all of my guest devices, you know anything else as a guest, they get these permissions. And so, and it can get pretty granular. So, you know, imagine if you were working in a business and you wanted to block Facebook, but the marketing department said, hey, we need Facebook to manage the company's page. Well, you can even go in there and granularly say that this department can post to Facebook, but they can't play games.
Yeah, and I think the sort of crucial thing to understand about this is that this isn't IP address and port-based filtering, right? This is actual deep packet inspection through the access points and through the switches, where you're looking at packets going past and Aerohive, our Hive manager, is trying to determine exactly what kind of traffic it is that you're sending through. So, for example, for services where they may go to multiple IP addresses, am I right, Bradley? People that use CDNs, for example, you could identify Netflix traffic without necessarily knowing one IP address for Netflix to block. That's roughly what we're talking about here, layer 7 control application.
It's all at the layer 7. Yeah. So, and then it gives you great kind of monitoring as well. So you could say, all right, you know, Jim in our development office is spending all of his time on Facebook, or he's got BitTorrent running, or he's spending from 2 to 3 every day, he's watching Netflix, or he's spending all of his time on YouTube. And so basically, I saw somebody said on Twitter, you can find out who the lazy bees are, the people who actually aren't working. So in an education perspective, you could say, all right, you know, this group of students is sitting on YouTube for 3 hours every day. You know, I obviously don't have a reason to be on YouTube that long.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say that one of the things for us is that some things can be used educationally and not educationally at the same time, YouTube being the number one example of that, you know. So what we need is a sort of layer 8 where it tells you the difference between Gangnam Style and actual educational videos on YouTube as well. But yeah, I agree with you. I'm pretty excited about the feature too, because I think one of my big reasons for going to a service like Aerohive and getting rid of our Apple base stations was not that the Apple base stations weren't working for us or anything like that. It was really that I wanted just more visibility, and not even that I wanted the control as much as I just wanted to be able to understand exactly what was going on the network. So one of the things that I understand about the feature is that the set of services that it recognizes and understands is built in to Hive Manager, and it's not currently extensible. So if the service that you're interested in is not actually detected, then that's going to be a feature request rather than something that you could script or write into Hive Manager as such. So I don't know, for example, if they could detect Evernote sync traffic or if they could detect App Store traffic, depending on whether those things are actually written into the service yet or not. But we can always make a list of our favorite feature requests. Maybe that's a show for after it all deploys, services that we want. Yeah.
One of the things spotted. I sent to a webinar today, and I asked the question, but then I had somebody call me out, so they probably answered it and I didn't get to hear it, was can we set some of these policies on a timer? Like right now I have my guest network. It disappears at 9 p.m. every night, and it doesn't reappear until like 5:45 every morning. So because I have no reason for a guest to be here in the middle of the night, obviously. Mm-hmm. And so what I would like to see is like, hey, can I block, say, this website inside of school hours? But if like somebody's here working, if a teacher's here working after hours doing some lesson planning and they want to watch, you know, a clip on YouTube or some other website that we might or might not block, you know, I would like to let them do that. You know, so you kind of set it where, you know, during work hours, it's one set. Mm-hmm. Then outside of work hours, it's another set of policies.
Yeah, I think one has to be very careful with doing that kind of thing, because if you get the time boundaries wrong, people can end up quite confused. Like, well, this was working an hour ago. What's going on? And unless you do a kind of good education job with your users, you can end up sort of answering the phone a whole lot, explaining to them, oh, well, I turned it off at this hour, but not that hour, and so on. So maybe it's something that's better done for guest networks or student SSIDs rather than... I'm generally in favor of staff having a pretty consistent experience throughout the day. And I think with something like the application visibility that Aerohive are going to deploy, you could do a good job of just, you know, looking at the heaviest users and just having a quiet word sometimes rather than necessarily setting policies to try and control their behavior instead of just having a chat, you know. But that's something to be finessed in every workplace by itself.
Oh, yeah, because like the first day that I changed the guest SSID to being on schedule, I had originally set it for 6 o'clock because that's when our Family Life Center opened. Well, when I came to work out that morning, about 6:15, the guy that was working there, he said, hey, the internet's not working. I pulled up my phone. I said, no, I'm online right now. He said, well, the guest network isn't working. I said, well, it didn't come back on until 6. And he said, oh, I got here like at 5:45 to open up and usually get my laptop out and connect it to the guest network and listen to music. And so I said, oh, okay. So he's, you know, I in my mind, they open at 6, but the gentleman that opens gets there like at 5:45.
Got to know your users.
So
you got to face them as well.
So that'll be out at some point soon. Another thing we didn't mention is you can do kind of traffic priority. So you can say, well, hey, I don't necessarily want to block Netflix or YouTube, but I don't want them to be able to kind of gobble up all of my bandwidth. And so you can kind of prioritize traffic as well. And that's exciting.
That was one reason why I called out, you know, can it tell the App Store apart from other things? Because perhaps one of the things I might like to do is to have App Store updates be either particularly fast or you know, deprioritized depending on the situation, particularly for some students who have the possibility of updating their apps at home. I could say, well, if you want to try and update them here, okay, you can do it, but it's going to be slower. And for those kids who have to do it in school, they get more priority, things like that.
No, I like that. That's a good idea.
There's some good options in there, hopefully, and we'll definitely report back once it's deployed.
Again, links to all that stuff will be in the show notes on the website or in your favorite podcasting client. Cool. So I guess we'll kind of go through the listener feedback here. Mm-hmm. I'll start with one today from Scott Murphy. And Scott had a great question that I have dealt with in recent weeks. I would like to know your thoughts on Apple's recent use of X Protect to disable Adobe Flash in Java, especially if users aren't administrators on their machines. Also, on at least one occasion, the Java update hadn't been released yet, so you were unable to use Java apps. The main reason Java is on our staff machines is for PowerSchool's PowerTeacher Gradebook. So PowerSchool is a pretty popular student information system. We actually demoed them when we were changing a few years ago. So I have actually dealt with this. We have our air conditioning controllers on the network. So going back to everything's on the network, we can manage our big, gigantic air conditioning systems from the web. Well, like any good software not written by someone who cares, it is written completely in Java. So the few people that use those are on Macs, and they were using Safari by default. So it immediately stopped working when Apple kind of flipped that switch. So I hadn't realized that Apple had done that, so I'm kind of Googling it and see some support discussions from, you know, a few minutes ago where people were reporting it. So basically told the people, hey, just use Firefox right now, and it worked. So best I can tell, it only disables it in Safari.
That's my understanding of how that works as well. It's kind of ironic. Scott mentions that PowerSchool, of course, used to be owned by Apple at one time, didn't they? I think back in a long, long time ago, Apple owned PowerSchool for a while.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, yeah, I think it's something that, you know, increasingly Flash and Java are fairly serious vectors for zero-day attacks. And, you know, obviously there was that story recently about Apple and Facebook and various other companies were in fact attacked by some of these vectors. And I think it's one of these things that if you do get a zero-day, you know, people are going to exploit that, particularly with these big attack surfaces like Flash and Java. So it's one of these things that you've got to, when they throw the switch, they really have to throw it. And it's drastic, but sometimes it has to be done. And I think if they were doing it for every little potential thing that could possibly go wrong with Flash and Java, then they wouldn't ship Flash or Java. Oh, wait, they have stopped doing that, of course. So this is one of the reasons why these things aren't, you know, by default in the operating system anymore, is because they're kind of, they should be updated on a fairly rapid schedule, it seems, from the vendors. But yeah, it's one of these things. I think it's time to move away from some of these plugins because they are, you know, as much a liability as a help in many cases.
Yeah, it'll drive you nuts because you've got so many of those kind of legacy applications that,
yeah,
you know, like, again, our air conditioning controllers, we're probably, I mean, it's not like we can just immediately switch to someone who doesn't use that. And the same thing with PowerSchool. You're pretty invested in PowerSchool, and if they're still heavily reliant, you're kind of between, you know, a chicken or a rock and a hard place. So my only, I guess, wish list that maybe if you're like a GSX administrator with Apple, that you might get an email say, hey, we've you know, enabled this. If you get any calls, if your users are, you know, have to use Java for a known safe app, try using alternative browser in the meantime, you know.
Yeah, I guess at some level, Apple just wants it to be not their problem. You know, that can be Chrome's problem, or it can be Firefox's problem or something. But I think, particularly in situations where there isn't an update out yet, it's a, maybe occasionally a bit much to throw the switch. But if the threat is as serious as people say they are, then I guess you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah, that's true.
Next question comes from Sandy, who writes from Hong Kong. He says he's managing sort of shared iPads used by lower primary students and looking for a better workflow for getting projects off the iPads. Right now we email or card up, connect with the card if the file is too large to email. Have we talked about school e-locker on any of the episodes? We're thinking about piloting. Any thoughts? Now, I don't specifically have experience with school e-locker as such, but I've heard of and I've heard people enthuse about other such products. One, I know a few people who use this one, which is called eBackpack. And in general, these are basically cloud storage services that have some kind of iPad-specific ways to get content into them. Obviously, you can typically email to these services, but also they present WebDAV over the internet so that you can connect from apps that support WebDAV. What Sandy doesn't mention is he doesn't say what exact kind of projects he's talking about. I'm guessing video, because that's typically the one that becomes too large to email. And recently we've been using the Dropbox application just to get those off the device, because the Dropbox will reach into the camera roll and you can pick files of, as far as I can tell, arbitrary size and then upload them to Dropbox. Now that can be pretty slow at times, but it does in fact work. The problem remains, and the more we kind of get into this, the more we start to ask ourselves questions like, well, where do we want to go with these files? Why are we trying to get them off the devices? And one of the reasons you're typically wanting to get these projects off the device is either for because they're shared, and we've discussed that before, the fact that the more data you generate on these devices, the more you're really leaning towards a one-to-one situation. Or the second one being that you have to store them for some kind of grading purposes or archival purposes. And that's something that I think right now there's not a really good solution for. We've talked previously about trying Evernote for that. The thing we've bumped into with Evernote is every note can only be 100 megabytes. So some of those larger projects are going to blow Evernote's limit as well. Looked at Dropbox for some of them. Looked at on-site storage for some of them as well. And there's nothing I'm absolutely delighted with right now. And I think that's something that we could certainly stand to see some help with, either from Apple or from a major third party coming in doing a major product that really solves that problem.
Yeah.
So, yeah, good question.
It seems like there's kind of a lot of room here to grow. It is hard because it's a, you know, it'd almost be like if there was some way you could have some sort of little thing you plugged into the Lightning port that had a little memory stick on it, but I guess then the app would have to know. I don't know. That's not an easy problem to solve, and that's why we kind of do have so many kind of copycats.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with plugging mass storage into the Lightning port on an iOS device is that there's no, essentially no file system is exposed. So the idea of I'll just copy this file from here to there, well, there's no file, there's no here, and there's no there. And that's, you'd have to sort of fundamentally break the interface metaphor of iOS to just, you know, install mass storage and copy stuff onto that. A little bit of that has been done with the camera connector kit. because obviously you plug that in and then the camera, the Photos application opens and it can sort of import from mass storage, but that's a very specific file type. And I think I sort of fundamentally feel that plugging in storage is the wrong way to do this. But at the same time, we haven't really got the workflow for doing it a better way. And one of the things I kind of wish, at least for the video part of it, is that if the Photos app supported OpenIn, you could then send it to whatever application you decide is the one that's going to work for you. But for now, Dropbox is quite a good way to reach into the camera roll and pull things out from there. But then there's obviously other apps now that are starting to create larger files. I'm thinking of one we were talking about today in school, which was an app called Book Creator, which makes EPUB files on the iPad, which is great. And for the most part, we've not had a problem moving those away. But Book Creator now supports audio recording into the book and also importing video into the book. So these books are starting to grow in size as well. And a conduit for getting large files off the device wirelessly I think that's really that's a big wish of mine for iOS 7, is that there will be some kind of conduit that makes sense for large files, transferring them across a network rather than sort of giving up on that problem and going back to plugging in mass storage. So I think there's definitely something to be done there. Because if you think about it, a lot of the applications support email this thing because email is built in at the lowest level as a system API that developers can say, oh, make me an email, fire that off for me. Whereas WebDAV, by contrast, is not a system-wide supported service. It's something that every app has to kind of build in for itself. And that's why WebDAV is not so broadly supported. And if you build your workflow on WebDAV, then you end up sort of only being able to use those apps that can export their stuff through WebDAV. Whereas we're looking, I think we should have a few more things that are a bit more generic at the lowest levels of the system that developers can hook into that would then enable them to send larger files to various other places, wherever those places end up being.
Next question is from Chris Brandt. He's at the Vet School at UC Davis, and he's in charge of the Student Computing Initiative. And since 2006, they have required their students to choose between a specific image tablet PC or a 13-inch MacBook Pro. I know which one I would choose, but I expect that we'll offer the same options again this year, and I'm looking into options for moving to iPad starting in 2014 for the class of 2018. My current stumbling blocks are computerized testing and a more elegant, efficient, and precise note-taking interface. And he's kind of references fine annotations of medical images without risk interference. We currently run Sakai instance for delivery of the curriculum. They're looking at iTunes U, but with all the team teaching we do and automation that we have set up to support our faculty, I'm concerned about moving to the consumer model that Apple has provided so far. I'm hoping they will support multiple instructors for a course by then. So yeah, that's an interesting problem, and that kind of really is a great lead off of the previous question on that we kind of have these workflows that we need really something built in from Apple to be able to to make that efficient. Again, going back to having a file that's 150 megs that you've got on an iPad, and you need to get that off of 15 iPads, without hosing the wireless network. What do you do?
Yeah, I mean, maybe the answer to that is actually that iTunes U needs to grow an upload feature as well as a download feature. I mean, what you said there, the problem of moving 150 meg files around, we've essentially solved that problem for the teacher to student side of that, which is that we put it on iTunes U and the kids can download it from the iTunes CDN, which is, the fastest thing in the business and, is designed to handle multi-gigabyte file downloads to iOS devices. That all works just fine. But perhaps an iTunes U upload API built into the system might be a great thing. Upload this file to iTunes U into your class space or your personal space or whatever would be a really powerful, if iTunes U started to take on some of the inbound side of that as well, that would be a pretty cool feature.
Well, kids could submit their homework like at night and it would just download on the teacher's iPad, while she's sleeping.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that the opportunity is ripe there to do something pretty cool on the inbound side. And I think it's one of those situations, kind of like the original copy and paste thing, where, they haven't done a half-hearted effort. They've done nothing about that. And then my hope personally would be that something in the future happens where we get more of a round trip experience for content between students and teachers through iTunes U. But what Chris also mentions there is he talks about automation. So one of the things that iTunes U doesn't have very much of either is like any kind of API for hooking into iTunes U and doing things without necessarily a teacher logging in through a web browser and then manually doing something in the web interface. That's all kind of the way it works right now. So it's certainly, there's a lot of opportunities there to hopefully tighten up the integration between iOS and iTunes U as well, such that there maybe could be some APIs that would allow people to upload stuff to iTunes U through various applications rather than just necessarily confining it all to the iTunes U application itself.
Well, you could even see maybe syncing of class rosters from some of the more popular student information systems. Maybe grading something in iTunes U creates an automatic entry into the gradebook and say your RenWeb or PowerSchool or your whatever student information system you use. And yeah, that automation would be nice, because I guarantee you if they kind of opened up iTunes U, from an API perspective, every major kind of educational vendor would want to be kind of using that as their platform. Hey, we're compatible with it now. If you're RenWeb, hey, grade in iTunes U and it's automatically created in your RenWeb gradebook.
Lots and lots and lots of headroom there. You can get the feeling. I mean, iTunes U is great as is, but one can imagine that iTunes U 2 and iTunes U 3 could be some really pretty cool stuff. Okay, next question. Actually, three questions in a row from our friend Scott Boucher. We'll just take them one by one, I think. Does that suit you okay, Bradley?
Yeah, that's great, because they're kind of three distinct questions.
They are, yeah. So the first one is, Scott writes, I read a blog about a school that's implemented a one-to-one program using $250 HP netbooks and the Linux OS. The blog author felt that the cost savings made the solution a far better option than the iPad. I don't know much about Linux other than it's a free open source OS, but my question is how much software is available for that OS? Also, how easy would it be for teachers and students to use? How easy is the OS to manage across a large site deployment? And do I have any thoughts on their configuration? So I guess I can't speak directly to their configuration because Scott didn't put a link into that, but I guess a couple of things. My feeling with Linux, I mean, I used Linux back when it was compiled for 68K Max, right? So MK Linux was back in the day was the way, and then PowerPC Linux, all through the late 90s, I was using Linux on Apple hardware mostly, but and then I was administering Linux as part of my previous job as a systems administrator for the Large Hadron Collider project. So I'm pretty familiar with Linux and where it's good and where it's bad, and I think where Linux really shines, I don't know if you agree with me on this, Bradley, but where I think Linux really shines is as a server OS, and the fact that you can provision as many machines as you want, virtual or otherwise, and do some really, really cool stuff on the server side with Linux, I think is great for there. I'm not really that convinced by Linux on the desktop. I mean, it's a sort of standard joke amongst the Mac people on Twitter that, this year is going to be the year of Linux on the desktop or whatever. And I think it's certainly cheaper. It's free, right? So how much cheaper can you get? But I think the old adage that Linux is only free if your time is worth nothing is kind of true on the desktop. It's more true on the desktop than on the server, because on the server side, there's lots of automation tools. So the question of how easy is it to manage that OS deployment? Well, if you're deploying Linux across a cluster, for example, there are some really great tools to manage the configuration of clusters of computers running Linux. Whereas on the desktop, I just don't feel that the user experience is as polished as it needs to be for the generality of people who work in schools and for the generality of people who use computers, let's face it, because Linux has not been very successful as a user-facing operating system. So I think that works really well if you have a very strong kind of hacker tech culture in your school. But I don't know of many schools who have got such a strong culture like that that you could easily deploy Linux without a lot of support and training and evangelism from certain people in the school who are really, really keen to see Linux succeed for whatever reasons, technical or political or financial or otherwise. I think that's my kind of take on Linux as a user-facing operating system. It could work, but I think it's probably one of the most challenging things you could do in a school.
No, any thoughts on that? Well, I agree. From a server perspective, it's you know, I would say one of the most popular that's out there, but I just don't think it works on a, you know, end user platform. It's just the integration, the simplicity, the ease of use is just not there. Yeah, it just doesn't work. I mean, again, it's free, but if we were just looking out for costs, we certainly wouldn't be deploying Macs and iPads. We'd be deploying, you know, Kindles or Nexus 7s if it was just about cost. Sometimes, you know, I will pay a little bit more for something that's more integrated, you know, easier to use, and really just has more applications available.
Well, I think it also sometimes comes out of a question of, well, how are your budgets structured? Do you actually account for people's effort as part of the cost of doing what you do? Because if you don't count people's time, then that might seem like a very appealing thing to do, because it drives the software cost and the hardware cost down and down and down. But one of the things we've always tried to do at Cedars is factor in staff time, because we don't have a big staff. And I manage all of this stuff as well as teaching and as well as doing other things as well. We don't have three or four technicians and people to kind of set this up for us. We've got to have stuff that is time efficient as well as financially efficient as well. And I think you've really got to count both of those things to kind of get the efficiencies that you're looking for in schools now.
Yeah, we kind of pride ourselves on running a really lean staff as well, especially from an office standpoint. We, you know, I consider myself to be an expense. You know, I don't really bring in any revenue. Our teachers bring in the revenue. And so, you know, from, you know, I don't want to have to, you know, hire two or three more people to work for me so we can manage, you know, a Linux OS on the desktop to write, you know, custom drivers and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's the same thing too. You know, people ask a lot of time, have you built custom apps for your iPads and stuff like that? And it's the exact same argument. You know, that's a massive cost. And I think people who ask that question don't always appreciate just how expensive it is to build a good application. So the answer is always no way. That's crazy talk. You know, we don't have that kind of money. So, listen, I know you've got a hard deadline, Bradley. Do you want to leave some of these questions for next week? We'll take some more later on.
I think, well, let's go ahead. Let's go ahead.
Okay. Okay. Great. So next question is, do we know of any comprehensive research studies that compare the various hardware OS platforms for schools? It'd be nice to have some credible sources to reference when making a recommendation to our school board. The tricky situation we're in with that right now is that we're only 3 years into the new generation of tablets, you know, the post iPad era and all the other tablets that have come along since. So everybody's kind of waiting for somebody else to do a lot of these things, I think. And there's some good evidence coming out about iPad now, but my sense is that people using other platforms are just starting their comparative pilots right now. And obviously Windows 8 has only just come out. Android has only really gotten up to a pretty reasonable version of the OS within the last sort of 8 to 9 months with Android 4.x. So doing those comparative things, I think there's still going to be a wait for some of that to come out. But I know of one school in Scotland, they're doing a trial currently with 9 different devices. And it would be really interesting to hear. I know I'm not going to name the people involved, but I know they listen to the show. So we're looking forward to hearing from them at some point as well. And we'll catch up with them once they get that all written up and sorted. But having had some conversations along that line with schools who have done these kind of comparisons, some people said, look, we've got, you know, the Galaxy thing, we've got the Kindle, we've got the iPad, and some of the kind of axes of comparison, it's not even a fair fight between iPad and the other things, you know. For example, ease of connecting to a wireless projector system, right? You know, that's kind of nailed with on the Apple side, and other people are still struggling with that kind of thing. So, you know, time will tell. And definitely if we hear about anything, we'll talk about it on the show at some point for sure.
On that note, I'm actually 2 chapters into the book you recommended last week, Never Mind the Laptops. Mm-hmm. Really, really enjoying it so far.
Yeah, that is a good one. It's definitely recommended. Official book of the show, I think. Don't know if they want that accolade or not, but they're going to get it. So, too bad. Last question from Scott. These are all on separate dates. He says his wife is a middle school principal who's been working to improve her school corporation, to move her school to one-to-one computing, trying to help as best he can from the outside and the information that we've provided has been pretty valuable. One of the points he's asked is about iBooks author, and in the episode we talked about ebooks, and he was just noting that perhaps it may be better to use software from companies like Adobe, who are a little more platform neutral, and your source formats being in something like Adobe InDesign rather than being directly into iBooks author. And I think one of the tricky things for an app like iBooks Author is that there are no good routes from something else into iBooks Author just yet. So it's not so much... You would like it to be the end of a publishing workflow, but at the moment it kind of is its own workflow, and people have to kind of commit to doing an iBooks Author book if they're going to do it, or at least a lot of kind of relay out when you do it in that product as well.
Yeah, that's a tough problem. As I talk to schools, and one of the things I've really come to realize that it's hard to start this kind of push into technology from the grassroots level, because you're going to hit so many stumbling blocks. Like, you kind of need the support at the top level of your school, of your district, to kind of make this happen, because that's where the money comes from to kind of get this technology. Those are the people putting pressure on your IT departments. Like, let's say you're a teacher, and you're wanting to do something new, then your IT department says no, you're kind of stuck. If you're especially in a big school district, you kind of can't, work around them. You kind of have to follow their policies. And so that's where, being something that's from the top of the organization, in my mind, is so key.
Yeah, and this kind of goes to the heart of everything we know about school improvement, is the quality of leadership is absolutely crucial. I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but I was talking to Ruben Puntadera, who's the author of the SAMR model that many people have kind of heard of as a model for technology adoption. And he said to me one thing that was really interesting. He said that from the work that he did with the state of Maine, he could use the breakage rates of devices in schools as a proxy for the strength of leadership in the school. So schools that were well-led and strongly led didn't break their devices, whereas schools that had weak or ineffective leadership tended to see much higher rates of breakage. And I thought that was quite an interesting idea. I can't say that I've tried to apply that to my own experience or to schools that I've met, but it was an interesting little takeaway from a conversation that I had with him. School leadership's absolutely essential, and I think that's as true if you're trying to bring up reading scores. It's true if you're trying to build a new building. It's true if you're trying to establish new sports teams. If it's a priority for the school, you got a good chance. If it's something that one teacher's being left to push on their own, close to no chance, I think, is not an unfair way to put it. Okay, last question, which is an enormous one, so I'm going to try and summarize. But Bruce Horn writes from California. He harks back to the show we did about AV equipment, and he has some comments that he reckons would be useful for listeners, and I don't disagree. I think they're all very useful comments. So one of the things he says is he really recommends Wolf Vision document cameras. He says they're expensive, but they are very simple to use as well. And some of them have their interfaces are very simplified, but also they have smart autofocus that can do things like ignore hands moving in front of them and staying focused on the page and so on. So he reckons that's an important feature for those kind of tools. And then this is something, I don't know if you've used these, Bradley. I've used them, or at least had a shot of them at certain trade shows. A company called iPevo, I-P-E-V-O, make a USB document camera, a very simple one on a stand that's about $70. And Bruce recommends that, and many other people have recommended that to me as well, as a basic way to get started with document cameras. And it certainly seems to be the one that most people talk about.
Document cameras, while I love them, and we use Elmos here, and they're absolutely very useful, you feel like in some ways that's an industry that's going to be just kind of displaced as the cameras in these tablets get better.
Wasn't there recently something that came out where it was like a document camera stand, but with fittings for iPads to sit on top? And then obviously the video is usually to Apple TV after that. So I think I can certainly see, document camera like frames come in, and then, perhaps better applications than the default camera for just showing the contents of the, of what the camera sees. But another thing Bruce mentions is he talks about in the US, he says, check to see if your state or school system has a contract with AV vendors for institutional pricing. Typically, and what he's saying, and we had some other feedback that said this as well, is lean on your vendor. If you have a reseller that's helping you with other stuff, lean on their expertise for projectors and AV equipment as well. And finally, and this is actually a really interesting point that I hadn't thought about, what he says is that rather than looking for a particular model of projector, look for a particular series. He says the major brands such as Epson, InFocus, Panasonic may change models frequently, but if you stay in the same series, they should have similar features. And that's something I hadn't really clocked, but I think is a really great point, is that, you know, features come and go, specs come and go, but, you know, the general market segmentation within these companies' offerings is typically fairly steady. And you've seen this with computers as well. You know, Dell have the XPS series and the Inspiron series and various other ones, and these have probably all been discontinued 15 years ago because I'm so out of date with PC stuff. But, you know, you get the idea. And I think that also goes for projectors too, so a pretty cool point as well. And that is all our feedback for now. So if you have any other questions, if you want to leave any comments, we have our web form at outofschool.net. We'd love to hear from you. We're going to beg for stars. Let's beg for stars.
Five stars, not one star. If you want to leave one star, just keep it to yourself.
Yeah. That can stay in your pocket. But save it up till you've got five of them and put them all into iTunes for Out of School. We would love that. It's really encouraging for us, and it also just helps other people find the show as well, which is really great. And I have to say that all the comments that I've read, it's harder and harder to kind of catch up with all the worldwide comments that are made through iTunes, so we don't necessarily see them all. But the ones I see in the UK store, and I think the ones in the US storefront, are all pretty positive as well. So we really appreciate all of that as well.
Yeah, there's one in the US store that calls you the Merlin Man of technology.
Well, I don't know where to go with that. I guess I can see I'm so angry right now. I need to lay down.
I thought that's a compliment, right?
I guess so.
Yeah, yeah, it was five stars. It was five stars, and so yeah. I think it was just more talking about like you're the expert. And so
Merlin's a good guy. He's I don't know if I can call Merlin a friend, but I have met him on a couple of occasions, and he's a super guy to get to know. Right.
I guess
we're done.
Yeah,
I can no longer hear a baby crying upstairs in my house, so I think either everything's quiet or I'm about to be divorced. I'm not sure what's going to happen after we get off this podcast here.
So. Well, for listeners of the show, these are like the 2 weeks of doom for Fraser and I, because the time I've already had my time change and you have not, and so just kind of throws us all off. I never know what time. I sit on Skype for 3 hours and just hope he shows up. So we'll record
sometimes. That works, sometimes it doesn't. What can I say?
So, all right, everybody. Thanks for listening this week. Guess we'll be back next week.
Same time, same channel.
See you, everybody.